we've been at it for, I don't know, more than a dozen years. Yeah, hard.
Oh my, how did you get started working on this?
His fault. Columbia in close year 2000, and Susan Kodani from the Japanese Cultural Center approached Gene and said, hey, we want to document the closure. They want to tape it and that kind of thing. So then Gene started talking to Susan Kodani and said, hey, we're only about one Okinawan restaurant, and we're not necessarily old-timers or anything like that. Why don't you talk to HUOA and make some kind of a joint project? And she took the ball. She went to the board of directors at the Hawaii United Okinawan Association, got the approval, and got the ball rolling. Well, at that time, my daughter was the president of Uruku Ajujin Club. Being that Columbia Inn Kaneshiro is part of Uruku Ajujin Club, they said, okay, Holly, you got the project. So one night she comes home and says, hey, Dad, we got a project to do. That's how it all started.
Wow.
His fault.
Well, prior to that, you know, we began making a list of restaurants that was owned by Okinawan families that belonged to our club. Yeah, that's how it started. And then I looked further than that, and we found out that it went, you know, there was many more other Okinawan families that didn't come from Oroku, but came from other places in Okinawa. So that's how it all, you know. So we finally started to put things down on paper. And as we were making the list and cross-checking, we found so many restaurants. And then when people found out about this list that we were compiling, it went further and further, and people came out of the woodwork and said, you know, my grandfather and my grandmother had a restaurant down in so-and-so place and all that. The name was this and all that. Oh, gosh, you know, we were inundated with information.
Really?
Yeah, and Howard and I, we don't know how to document these things. And his daughter helped us by doing all the graphics, running a, you know, I mean, gosh, I didn't even know what Excel was, but we started a list. And, you know, and we said, wow, this has an interesting story to it. I wonder why so many Okinawans who came here, the first generation, more than likely came because of sugar. Then when they got out of the sugar business or working for the mills, they decided they're going to come to Honolulu and open a restaurant. And you wonder, why restaurants? We don't know. Maybe because that's probably one of the easiest things to go and work in without experience. And then get experience, find some tanamoshi, you know, some funding, what we call capital, and a lot of guts and family backing. And I think what we found out too was more important. We found out that the Okinawan community was willing to help each other rather than be competitors. On the surface, it looked like competition between Columbia Inn and Wisteria and Likiliki and Flamingo and all that. And the general tendency was to compare one restaurant against the other. But in fact, we all knew each other, and we were willing to help each other.
And what?
And because of that, all the restaurants became successful. Yeah.
Did you see that happening too?
Sure. You got to remember now, even today, you put all the restaurants together, the number of seats in the restaurant compared to number of people wanting to go to a restaurant, you can get full house everywhere if you have good food at reasonable prices, okay?
What were the
from our documentation, Mr. Ushi Takara, we have Okinawan name called Yago, okay? His Yago was Amiku. And he started American Cafe in 1923, okay? If you go down on King Street between Alakia and Bishop, his restaurant was there. That was number one restaurant at that time. All of the business people, the legislators and whatnot, used to be patrons of his place.
American Cafe, really? Yes. What was it like? Had boots or just
tablecloth?
Oh, not.
Waiters with bow ties and white shirt and white aprons.
No, really?
Yeah. What Mr. Takara did was, you know, all the people coming off the plantation, he would invite them to work, okay? Start with dishwashing, peel potatoes, wash pots and pans, and he taught them the trade, okay? Eventually, they became cooks, they became chefs, and when they came good enough, he said, hey, you go across the street, go open your own restaurant. And he supported the guys doing that. And there was another person called Mr. Harry Wehar from Kiwalo Inn. He was another mentor in a similar fashion, okay? Mm-hmm. These two guys always, when we talk to the old-timers, these two guys' names always come up.
So as where was Wehar's place?
His was by
Ward Warehouse.
Alamoana Boulevard.
Ward and Alamoana.
Which side?
And that, right where the spaghetti factory was. And do you know that one of the restaurant manager that was Stephen Nagamine, who started Flamingo? He had the key to the restaurant to open up in the morning, so he was designated as the manager. And that's where he learned his trade.
And he opened Flamingo?
Yeah, and you know what Flamingo did? They opened a bunch of restaurants.
You know, Flamingo had at least half a dozen different restaurants and venue, right? Mm-hmm. Chuck Wagon and all of that.
What was the secret for the success of the restaurants?
I think that the main thing was they had good food at reasonable prices.
What kind of food?
And American they really food. Worked hard. They really worked hard, okay? Gene knows better about the menu than I do. But you get things like hamburger steak, cutlets, steaks, chops, stew, curry, typical American food.
Yeah. Wow, so that would be like roast beef sandwiches at lunchtime.
And then if you notice, most of the restaurants were named either Hawaiian names or very American-sounding names, like Cafe Manhattan or Honolulu Grill or Kuhio Grill, Alakea Grill, and so forth, or generic type names like Columbia Inn that sounds American and so forth. And I guess the relationship between Japan and America wasn't too cool prior to the war. So if we named it Kaneshiro Inn, we get a rock through the window. So we named it Columbia Inn. It sounds very American, like the Columbia River or Columbus, Ohio, and so forth and so on. And then you serve American food anyway, so... You know,
My God, but Columbia Inn, your location. Okay, tell me about your patrons.
Well, we were located down at Beritania in what today is Mauna Kea Street, the Chinese Cultural Plaza that had a Hakubunda bookstore in the corner. Now, that's the original, 1941. My uncle and my father decided they're going to open the restaurant on Monday, December 8, 1941. They were in the restaurant cleaning up, getting ready on Sunday morning, and the bombs dropping. You know, my father said, oh, our relatives came a little bit too early. But nevertheless, in 64, we moved to the Kapiolani location next to the newspaper building. And that used to be a restaurant that was formerly Times Grill, formerly owned by Albert and Wally Teruya, Times Supermarket. And that's why. And because the restaurant was located next to the advertiser, like LA Times, New York Times, I guess Times in their mind, you know, his newspaper, the relationship. Albert and Wally sold the restaurant to another Okinawan family, and then they opened Times Superette in McCully and parlayed that into Times Supermarket. Then we bought from that Okinawan family in 64 and ran it until about 1989 or so, thereabouts. Anyway, we sold it to a Japanese corporation. Yeah. Well, you know, but being a restaurant in the middle of Chinatown, my father coined it Columbia Inn, the gem in the slums.
The original one.
And then when we moved to Kapiolani, he said, oh, this is now Columbia Inn, the top of the boulevard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then he decided Budweiser, at the urging of Budweiser, they put in Budweiser draft beer, and my father named it the coldest Bud draft in town, and had the mugs, the beer mugs, in the frozen chest. And when you draw the beer, it's nice and cold, and that became a signature.
Oh, man. Yeah. So many memories, right?
Right.
But how is it that this, so that's the way, it kind of this whole network of, what, 75 restaurants
right.
started?
Yeah, that's, we're just talking about, HOA is 50 clubs. We're one club, Urukuazajin Club, all right?
Okay.
Our clan itself had 75 restaurants that we could document. Okay, so today we have a listing of over 300, which includes all of the other 49 clubs, so you know, and statewide.
Oh.
So the Wisteria family, is they're from a different club. Their grandma and grandpa came from Okinawa. The same story. They get their experience somewhere, and they get tanamoshi, family backing, and a lot of guts, you know, and willing to work at it. And you know, the Casey Drive-In, I think, is where they started. Then Wisteria, you know, and all the other ventures that go along. The sister is married to Nako, who is Liki Liki Drive-In.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, what are they sad that many of these restaurants didn't continue in the family?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, this business is 24/7. It's really hard work. And you cannot let up. What happens is that families get burnt out, one. Two is that, like myself, my father sent me to college. He didn't want to be working behind a hot stove, okay? So I went to UH. I got out as a civil engineer. So then the family, no need to do anymore already, you know? They took care of the kids. We okay. They're all right. They retired. And in those days, nobody talk about franchise, eh? Not like today, okay? So I think the closest we have to franchise is Zippy's,
yeah.
Okay, the Hager family. They got something like over two dozen restaurants, including Neighbor Island like that, you know. It's amazing.
Another Okinawan family, huh?
Yes.
In my case, I'm Sansei. So I was kind of a throwback, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing at the UH. And therefore, my father looked at me and said, why don't you come and work with me in the restaurant until you find yourself? Well, I enjoyed the work. Although we did work hard, he allowed us to have some fun. And we were running 24 hours, 7 days a week.
Awesome.
And yeah, and the good fortune is that we were successful at it. And, you know, I enjoyed what I was doing. When my daughter was, I think, almost ready to graduate from Punahou, I asked her, Jenny, you want to join me in the restaurant business? And she looked at me and said, are you crazy? Realizing how hard we had to work, you know, to make the restaurant successful. And so she said, oh, no, yeah, I'm going away to school, you know. And therefore, the end of the family line ended there. You know, we only had one child. My two brothers was away doing other things and so forth, yeah.
So I think that was the common thread for many of the families. You know, they were successful in what they did. They educated the kids. They did okay economically. So they said, hey, I'm going to retire, and that's it. Because the younger guys didn't want to take over. They look at the parents working. They said, hey, this is crazy. I know I did.
So no, you know, and that's why I give credit to people like Alan Wong and Roy Yamaguchi and, you know, and all those guys were coming up with this whole new concept called fusion, okay? And, you know, and the Pacific Rim, you know.
Yeah.
And today, chefs are becoming owners of restaurants. Unlike in the past, restaurant managers usually owned the restaurant. Chefs used to work for them.
What difference will that make, do you
think? I think the availability of capital, you know, funding to build and open, you know, their own restaurant, and their ability to be creative to meet the market,
yeah.
And look at, you know, Mark Noguchi, and his pop-ups all over the place. You know, I tell you, I really support them. You know, I like what they do. To me, that's the new generation, you know. And so old restaurants like Colombian may have already bided its time, you know. I think that the newer restaurants is catering to the new market, and they're successful at it.
So, you know, like Gene talking about these high-end people now, Alan Wong and those guys, they're smart. They focus their hours on certain time of the day. They're not going like before Colombian, almost 24 hours a day. You got to worry, 24/7. When the customer's in, busy. When the customer's not there, you got a headache because you got to get income, you know, things like that. These guys on the high end now, they say, I'm going to open for lunch, dinner, and that's it. Or only dinner, whatever they want to do. But like Gene's saying, this is a new generation looking at a new market.
Are there a lot of Okinawans chefs now or restaurants
you know,
now?
There are some, not that many.
I cannot even name, though, you know, any. You know, that's a good question. But, you know, if I can turn back the clock, when in 1990 I went to work for the Department of Education and I was the director of the school lunch program.
Oh, yeah.
When I was doing that, we had 202 kitchens. Therefore, we had about 202 cafeteria managers. And I don't know if you went to public school, but the cafeteria manager was always in a white dress with hairnet and all that. You know, the classic description of a cafeteria manager. Well, as I visited the schools and met the managers, so many of them were Okinawan women who were cafeteria managers, bakers, cooks, you know. And I began to think, why is that? Well, I guess during that time or prior to that, as they came up the ranks, they didn't have, you know, the tanamoshi maybe for the capital. Maybe they didn't have the backing of, you know, anybody to open their own restaurant. But they became very successful cafeteria managers who knew exactly how to meet the market, school kids. And they were good at it. Cafeteria managers of Okinawan ethnic group. There were a whole bunch of them. And they used to quietly come up to me and say, hey, I'm Uchinanchu, meaning I'm Okinawan, you know. Because they may have married and they have a Japanese name, or they may have a Portuguese name or something like that. And I was so surprised. And I was really proud, you know, to see that even the women found a way, the Okinawan women, found a way to move up. And we're talking about...
In the food business.
Yeah, in the food business. We're talking about second and third generation.
What about the side businesses of food? Like, you know, I was talking to the guy who owns Aloha Tofu, his family, all the... fish cake.
Well, you know, it was a natural thing for our chef to buy his produce, you know, from Higa Meat or from Fred's Produce. Yeah, because that camaraderie amongst the Okinawan people is not so much prejudice. It was just the willingness to support each other. And so, yes, you know, when you start looking around for somebody to buy restaurant supplies, you know, you go look for a company that has a guy who's Okinawan salesman, and you develop a relationship with them. You know, and, you know, they'll give us the best price and supplies and so forth and so on. It goes throughout all the services and supplies and food that a restaurant there will need.
You know, like anything else, if you're going to do something, you go seek out a friend, things like that. Well, same thing like in this business, you know. The Uchinanchu people would support one another. And that's one of the things we learn is the cooperative thinking and what they did to help each other out.
So that was like the built the network for the original restaurants that now the children who are so highly educated can move into nuclear physics and stuff from that.
This is where, you know, we have traditional things trying to have our youngsters keep up the trend, okay? Annually we get a New Year's party for our clan. that's held on the first Sunday of March. And then we have an annual picnic, summertime, third Sunday of July, you know, that kind of thing. Plus, there's an Okinawa Festival, Labor Day weekend, all right? Trying to bring the young guys in and continue the spirit of cooperation and understanding, learning about each other, that kind of thing.
Does Tanamushi exist now? Could it?
I think if it does, it's more a social group of, amongst people. Like my mother used to belong to a group of ladies that was from Liki Liki, Wisteria, and Wiki Wiki Coffee Shop. And they all used to get together. And it was more a social group.
The thing about Tanamushi is when our grandparents came from Japan, they had no credit, they owned no land, they had no references, right? They could not walk into the bank and say, I want to have a $5,000 loan. And say, who are you? You don't, they kick you out. But you have friends and family that trust you, knows you, and they're willing to invest in their tanamoshi, right?
How much money do you think that would be about that?
It depends. Some would be like only $10 a month.
That they would contribute to
because you're talking about the time, okay? Even $10 a month, maybe it was even less than that, 50 cents or dollar a month. Depending. Old days, remember, they used to work for $1 a day, okay? I benefited personally from a tanamoshi. Our tanamoshi, we had 60 people with $100 a month. So that thing lasted for 60 months, all right? The person sponsoring that takes the $6,000, no interest paid. From the 59th person on, you got to bid for it, okay? Whatever you want to bid.
Bid what?
To borrow the money.
To get the highest bid that takes the $6,000.
And then they pay.
They have to pay all the other people. Yeah. So if I bid $25, I'm the 59th person. I'm going to pay the 58 other guys $25 each. Then I keep the balance. Yeah. Then the next person does the same thing. Until the last person, the 60th guy, you collected all the interest previously, and you take the $6,000. Okay?
Very complicated, but nevertheless, was a source of capital.
But the main thing was you have to have people that you could trust and know, because anybody defaulting that, the system breaks down. Okay, so I was part of that, one of the last ones, and I used my $6,000, part of my down payment for my house. Okay, this is back in 1969.
But how did you feel as part of this chain of people?
Oh, very comfortable.
But the responsibility on you as well.
Oh, no. But me, I was just one of the participants.
You can't default, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it goes back to when my grandfather settled in Hakalau finally. Mm. And they formed this organization called the Oroku Azajin Club, okay? And it was, the commonality was, the people who were in that club came from the same village in Okinawa. And they,
Oroku.
Yeah, and before they came here, they said, we're going to support each other. Now, every other Okinawan club had the same formation, okay? And so, because Howard and I are not related, our grandparents came from the same village in Okinawa. You know, we, you know, said we're going to take care of each other. Now, we have a funeral tomorrow. One of our club members' husband passed away. And so one of the major functions of this Oroku Club is to help with the funeral service.
We have a service committee.
So if they need help, you know, we are there to offer help. In any way, you know, whatever help they need, like the reception desk, or to help them MC the service if it's required, and those kind of things. So in order to keep the club going together, we talk about the New Year party, because our New Year follows the Chinese New Year. Okay, Okinawa calendar is a Chinese calendar. And then we have the annual picnic. So through those two major functions, we continue this organization that started way back in the 1920, yeah, 1923. My grandfather was one of the founding members of that of the club.
I remember that the Okinawans first came to Hawaii January 1900. So, you know, we're not here even 120 years yet.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Okinawan people. 117 years from me.
And now, my daughter lives on the mainland. She's the only child, you know, but she still is in touch because our newsletter reaches all the way to her. And the United Okinawan Association newsletter tabloid is mailed to her also. And then we have online, she can go online and look at what's happening. You know, and hopefully one day she and our 3.5-year-old grandson and our son-in-law will come back to Hawaii. You know,
and hopefully
continue the legacy of the people from Oroku. This is the documentation, you know, of what we were, you know. Now we're hoping we can fill in some of these boards, and that's why we're willing to, you know, to publicize this thing, not to embellish our own. Hey, we're too old for that already, you know. But we want people to bring us menus. We want them to bring us pictures, and we don't care what kind. Let us be the judge as how important it is. And Sherry Tamashiro, who's really interested in something like this, have been so helpful to us in that all of this material that you see here in some form or fashion will end up at the University of Hawaii archives or library or something, because there is a Department of Okinawan Studies, you know. Yeah, in fact, I was just going to call that person. We're looking for a student who's working on a master's degree or a doctorate degree, who wants to do a paper, who will hopefully help us do a paper.
Yeah.
Because see, what we're looking
for.
Pull
it all together.
Yeah, we're looking for the horse to help us. Because, you know, obviously I can't. And I don't know if Howard has the energy to do that. Yeah. But nevertheless, this is a ready-made paper, you know, just sitting here.
A lot of these guys, and this is talking about in the 20s and the Depression days to the 30s. Okay? So how do you get a quarter in your pocket, loose change? No way.
What could you do with it?
No, that's why we have a so-called hamburger story. You can, for a quarter, you can get a total meal.
Yeah.
Soup, salad, meal, dessert, and drink for 25 cents. But this is in the 30s now, you know? You know how many people had a quarter in their pocket back at that time? Not too many.
It seemed like it was $10.95.
Right.
You know what I mean?
In today's dollar, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a theory that, you know, because food is so important, people got into that business. You won't starve. Your family won't starve. People working there won't starve. Plus, you're meeting a need for the community, yeah?
But people couldn't eat out as much then,
No. But then, you know, prices were very reasonable, too. As those days, you know, 10 cents can go a long way.
If you can get 10 cents,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, look, and then look what happens, huh? Over here.
Yeah. So just paper off. There's none today. Of 75, none exist. Everybody retired. That's why I say it's tough business and people just no successors and that kind of thing, so, you know.
Times Supermarket. These are the Times Supermarket people?
Yes, yes.
It was his dream to have a market. And so he didn't make it back.
So the brothers picked up the torch and they went to the market business.
So that's Wally and
Kahana Times. There's a plaque there dedicated to Herman Terrier. That's one of the brothers.
So this is Wally and the right-hand side
Albert,
is
yeah.
Albert.
Yeah, number one son, number two, yeah.
Oh, my. Aloha Grill.
Yeah, this is the one we talk about the hamburger story.
Where's the Aloha Grill?
Yeah. Aloha Grill was on Bethel, and I don't know if you remember Chaplain Lane.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I know where that is.
It's behind the old Liberty Theater.
Oh, I see.
They used to have a little grill there. Upstairs was restaurant and whatnot. Downstairs, they had bowling alley. I think maybe you're a little too young to know, but you know Columbia Inn was the inn place to go, right, during its time? Before that Columbia Inn, Smile Cafe was a place, okay? Was started with American Cafe, then Smile Cafe. So you have here a lot of these guys, like, these guys look like a baseball, I mean, a military guy, but that's Major League, Stan Musial. A lot of the military guys, the professional athletes, went into the military during war.
You mean the local professional athletes?
No, you mean this national guy.
He's national. Okay,
he's one of Hall of Fame person, that kind of thing, you know? So through the military, they ended up coming here, you're saying? This is all Smile Cafe.
Where was Smile Cafe? It started right at Kalakaua
and Alamoano, where you have the highway there. This was up there.
They had to move
because the highway came through.
Alamoana and Kapiolani?
No, Kalakaua.
Kalakaua.
You have
and Kapiolani. That's where the convention center is.
That's different. Okay, that was the original location. Alamoana and Kalakaua. Right now, it's a highway over there.
Highway.
Yeah. You know, you pass Hawaiian Village, you on Alamoana Boulevard.
Yeah.
And you come to Kalakaua, right? Right at Dirusi, over there.
Okay, so that used to be the place.
Then they had to move because of the highway. And they moved to where you have basically today the Alamoana building, Keomoku and Kapiolani.
Yeah.
But then they had to move, they closed because of the Alamoana shopping center and that kind of thing. So if you look at this, it's 32 Waikiki. Then later on, they came to Kapiolani site after that. Okay,
wow.
They did some right here, 47. Then they closed after a while.
Gee, I never got to go to Smile Cafe.
Yeah.
And that was that the time when there was all kind of stuff on Keomoku, right? Like
Keomoku was
Scotty's and there was Liki Liki.
No, but I think at that time Keomoku was not that developed yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I should take you to the round table. Okay.
That's why they say if this table could talk, you know, it'd be an interesting conversation. We'd be watching TV and CNN News come on, you know, and they start talking about banking and so forth. Russ Lynch, who was the business writer for the Bulletin, he would pick up the phone. Let's see what the Malasada has to say about this. And he'll call Walter Dodds on his private line. And he goes, yep. He hang up. He look at everybody and says, well, stick around. I think some beer is coming. And Walter and what was his PR guy? Anyway, they come walking in the restaurant. Bring these guys around. So now, what about this banking story?
It's so funny.
We should do
those kind of days.
Crazy things.
Where can people hang out now?
I have no idea where everybody went. You know, but.
Where can people hang out now and do stuff like that?
No.
Why couldn't we do it there?
No, I don't think it can be done the same way because people drink less now.
Huh.
Yeah. They don't. Yeah. And you know, I guess it's just a different atmosphere.
You know what? I kind of feel like we're having a lot less fun these days.
No, I think the fun is not what you and I imagine or lived. They're having fun in many, many different ways.
So, if he's
yeah,
saying
unfortunately,
that, and the family's
political correctness trumps everything.
I like how you said
yeah.
that. Yeah. Oh,
jeez. And I had the privilege of running a restaurant next to the newspaper building. And I was privy to a lot of, you know, conversation.
And so and then, your location, you're saying, was part of it.
Location was one of them, but I think my father who nurtured, you know, the friendship. Yeah. with no pretense, you know. We just wanted to make a few bucks off selling beer.
He has a vision, though. The top of the boulevard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
But my father died at age 60. You know, and Smile Cafe was like the forerunner to Columbia Inn in terms of a sports hangout, politicians hangout. They were located where the Alamoana building is today. Prior to that, they were in Waikiki at Kalakaua, where Ala Moana comes up by Forte Rusi. That Ala Moana Boulevard came through, so they had to move. Then they opened at on Kapiolani Boulevard. Then they had to shut down because Ala Moana building was going to be built. Yeah. But that Uehara family, they had this nightclub named Keone's. That was the brother Johnny.
Huh.
And Keone's was the jazz club, live entertainment club. You know, people like Jimmy Borges when he was young. But, you know, Tommy Young and
Richard Cowley?
You know, yeah, and some of those, Ed Chunk and what's the lady that played the piano at the Pasadena?
Betty
Lou Taylor.
Yeah.
And all those guys, you know. Yeah, that was the club in Waikiki. And he's the family that used to own Smile Cafe. Yeah.
Okay. Service station.
Yeah. The other brother, Jimmy, was...
Fishing shop. Yeah. Different brothers. Huh? Yeah. Older brothers.
Story of entrepreneurship.
Oh, yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Grandma was it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But the Okinawan Festival was the first...
It was.
Ethnic festival. Okay.
Oh.
We started at McCoy Pavilion in Ala Moana Park for 2 years and outgrew that, and we moved to Thomas Square for a year, and then we went to Kapiolani Park. But I remember them coming to me and said, hey, can you help us coordinate the food side of that festival? This is close to, what, 30 years now?
At
30 years, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago. And I told them, oh, I cannot handle that big event and run my business, you know. I said, oh, okay, let me think about it. So I went to Charlie Higa over in Zippy's. I went to Roy Asato over at Wisteria, and Danny Nagamini over at Flamingo. I told them, guys, hey, this is what these guys want to do. Can you guys help me? If you say yes, I'm going to say yes, and then we, as a team, we go. Everybody said yes. Danny Nagamini sent his wife. Because Danny was an accountant. He was, you know, yeah. But nevertheless, you know, and I tell you, we started that thing. At 11 o'clock at night, we were over there sweeping up the McCoy Pavilion, and we looked at each other and we said, what are we doing? We're all the volunteers.
And then the next day was fantastic, right?
Yeah, and then the next day, okay, and then the next year, you know, and then the next year.
You guys are crazy.
But I guess deep inside there is a true, we know there's a true value for, you know, for this maintaining our roots. So my 3.5-year-old grandson, who's 1/8 Korean, 3/8 Chinese, 1/4 Japanese, and 1/4 Okinawan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope will.
I know.
Will know after his grandpa is long gone that there was a thing called an Okinawan club that got together. That would be his great. That would be his great great grandpa. That started when he came from Okinawa, Oroku, Okinawa to Hakalau, you know, and was part of the formation of this club called the Oroku, you know, the Oroku Aza. Aza is a small hamlet, maybe not even large enough to have a mayor. They probably had a headsman. You know,
a tribal leader.
Yeah, really, you know. And that And that years ago, they worked in the plantation, they got off the plantation, and some of them went into a restaurant business, and from the restaurant business, this is what happened. Now, there's no restaurant that's run by Oroku people anymore. They all went to something else. Like
you know, there's one though.
Oh.
You know Masaji's grandson?
Yeah.
He has Tatsuo's on Sand Island.
Tatsuo?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Where is that?
When you drive into Sand Island, yeah. The first road on the right, yeah. There's a small shop over there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Masaji's daughter married a Morito. And Wayne is a son, or grandson. Wayne and Laurie.
And the place is named Tatsuo.
Yep.
Okay.
Tatsuo's, okay, we got to check it out.
Alahau place.
Well, maybe that's the only one that we can remember. Now, there was an obscure little coffee shop named Bert's Cafe on Macaulay Street, just about a half a block Mackay of King Street.
Yeah, okay.
And that was Bert's Cafe, but it kind of opened whenever they wanted to.
That was the last one.
Yeah, that was the last one that we know of. It's closed now because it's that whole
that
block.
Sign.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you got
so, Tatsuo's, what he's doing, he's following up like Masaji.
Yeah.
He also caters to funerals and whatnot.
That's good.
That's where
know.
I saw him first time.
But you can see, you know, the writing on the wall where, you know, the classic story of Howard is repeated, you know, throughout.
My name is Sherry Tamashiro. I am a librarian at Kapi'olani Community College, but I'm active in the Okinawan community here. I do a lot of work with exhibits because I really believe in storytelling. I believe that we have to tell our stories. So in the Okinawan community, or even the Japanese American community, we have to tell our stories. And so I've been working on telling the stories of our community. So for the Okinawan community, it's how we sent over pigs to Okinawa to help them recover from World War II. It's stories of World War II and the Battle of Okinawa. But in our community in Hawaii, if we don't tell our stories, who's going to tell it? And the fact that there is a story, like over 325 restaurants were Okinawan owned, 75 of the restaurants from one clan, Oroku, is amazing. And, you know, I think it's great that we can tell the story to the community, to everyone in Hawaii, because there's so many lessons attached to it as well. It's not just, okay, so they owned a lot of restaurants. You learn about communities and people supporting one another. And a lot of our stories can actually be tied to Okinawan values. So there is an Okinawan value called Yui Maru. Yui Maru is a circle, and what it represents is communities supporting one another, especially in times of need. And so in big and small ways, you see Okinawans really going out of their way to help each other. And so the story of the restaurants, if you look at the Oroku story, you see Ushi Takara, you know, the guy who had the first restaurant, he's hiring people from Oroku and giving them a chance to work their way up and start their own business, you know, and make a success. And it's not a franchise. I think today we would say, okay, I'm going to start this business and I'm going to franchise and I'm going to make a lot of money having 30 restaurants, 75 restaurants. But then it was, no, I'm going to help you open up your own restaurant. And, you know, make it so that you can let your kids go to college. You can, you know, make a great life for your family, the American dream. But, you know, what you saw in practice as well was the restaurants helped each other out. You know, if one restaurant needed a cook, they would send theirs, even if it meant, you know, it would make it harder for them. Because Yui Maru, you know, we help each other out. And I think that's amazing.
The 30s is pretty much what we're talking about, right? But you know, the first one was 1923.
American Cafe, yeah.
And it just like came on the scene such so big time.
Yeah, tablecloths, air conditioning. But you know, you asked how I got involved in the project. You know, so Howard and Jean, they did something really amazing. They're not trained as historians and librarians or archivists. You know, Howard is an engineer whose father had a restaurant. Jean, you know, a second-generation restaurant owner. But when Columbia Inn closed and, you know, Jean was told by the executive director of Japanese Cultural Center, you need to document your story. You know, he said, we're part of a larger story, you know, the Oroku story. But they got to work. You know, they could have said, well, we don't know what to do. And they could have used the excuse everyone uses, which is, I'm too busy. They didn't. You know, they called all the restaurant families that were still around, told them to, like, they got together once a month for years to pull information from people's heads. It's like, okay, first thing we have to do is identify the restaurants. You know, the name of the restaurant, address, who owned it, when did it open, when did it close, you know? And they did that. And the remarkable thing, too, is that they would take the information and they would double-check, triple-check to confirm that it was correct as much as possible. That is a lot of work. And it's very tedious work, too. But they did it. And then they finished the 75 Oroku. And then they said, you know what? We got to do the others. All the other restaurants that are Okinawan owned. And they identified 250. And so we have a list of over 325. And, you know, the non-Oroku list is not as complete as it could be. It's missing information. And, you know, our list is very Oahu-centric because they didn't know as much information about the neighbor islands. And so it's still a work in progress. But what Howard and Jean did is remarkable. They saved the story because if they didn't put in those long hours of trying to get people together and, you know, compile and check the information, we would not have the details of this story. I think we would say, hey, I think there was a lot of Okinawan-owned restaurants. Do you remember how many? I don't know, you know, 50? And we would lose a big chunk of Hawaii's history. And we call that community archivism because it wasn't the university or historian who came in to study and do the work. This was people in the trenches, and, you know, people who are a part of the story actually recording and preserving it. And you don't see that enough. And I like what they did because it's a good example. Like, let's say in your own family, are you recording your stories? You know, are you writing down? Are you saving the photos? Are you, like, you're taping me on your phone. You could do that with your parents or your grandparents. But in a larger scale, in your community, or even in the entire state, why can't you do what Howard and Jean did? You know, and become community archivists. I think the window is closing of people having a memory of these restaurants, finding photographs or menus. And if, like I said, the complete list is not done. It's a work in progress. We're missing pieces of information. Obviously, we've missed restaurants. So this is something that, you know, when all the information goes online, we need the public to come in to help collectively fill in this information. Howard and Gina have taken it as far as it can go. So we need other people to step up. You know, we need somebody from Kauai or Maui to become the Howard and Jean of Kauai. We need people whose parents worked at the restaurant to ask, do you have menus? Do you have a photo? If you don't have that, can you write down your memories or record it for us? You know, because even if it's a story, a short story, that adds to our community of memory.
Well,
that
what
we
should
have.
They do with it?
If they send it to me. So oh, yeah. pics from the sea@gmail.com. Then I can compile all of it and put it all together. Because I really think that, like I said, the window's closing. People with memory of these things are not going to be around. And at that point, we really can't collect information. So how do we get it, right?